On December 21, 1993, Papa San's brother Patrick was murdered, 2 days before Christmas. Warnings followed. Skip Fort Clarence, watch your route. He had trained and applied for a firearm license. Denied. After the killing and threats, he carried anyway. The cost was immediate, a police record, border checks, a lost Pepsi deal. Yet stages stayed full. Fans still came. This is the hinge in his life, public momentum against private fallout, and the first quiet steps toward a different path. From sound system wars to sanctuary, told straight, no gloss. In late 1993, the arc of Papa San's life bent under a sudden weight. On December 21st, his brother Patrick was murdered, 2 days before Christmas. He later recalled the shock plainly, and the way the house fell into silence while the city kept moving. The timing mattered. It split his memory into a before and an after. The loss came at the peak of his visibility, when bookings were constant and crowds were easy to lift. The call made the room feel small. Grief settled fast. Warnings circulated almost immediately. Friends urged him to avoid Fort Clarence, a beach booking on his calendar. He says they told him people were watching and waiting. His mother-in-law pressed him to stay home. He had already tried a legal path for protection. He trained, did range time, applied for a firearm license, and was denied. After Patrick's murder and with threats in the air, he made a choice that would follow him for years. He armed himself without a license. He describes it as survival instinct more than image. It was for the walk to the door at night, for the drive on dark roads, and for the chance to live long enough to bury a brother. The fallout came in predictable ways. A police record created frictions at borders. He recalls being barred from Grand Cayman for 5 years and facing secondary screening in Canada because of the record. A commercial opportunity slipped away. He mentions a Pepsi ad he lost as management couldn't front an artist whose name had taken that turn. Promoters still called because he drew crowds, but the calculus around risk and venue security entered every conversation. He knew what the decision would do to the brand he built on speed, clean execution, and command of a stage. He took the hit and kept moving. In his telling, the period after December 21st carries two tracks, public momentum and private cost. On stage, the demand remained high. Fans shouted lines back, and the bookings did not vanish. Off stage, the administrative consequences multiplied. Papers, offices, and the cold rooms that separate a person from the main line at immigration. He speaks of it without drama. The record marks you. Some doors close. The world treats you like a file before it meets your face. The week of Patrick's death sits in his narrative as a hinge. He weighed whether to keep a Fort Clarence date and chose family and security over momentum. He points to the license denial as a key signal. He tried the straight lane, it wasn't offered. When credible threats followed a murder in the family, he took a narrow bridge. He is careful to say it wasn't bravado. It was fear and duty in a house full of relatives making plans for a funeral. From a career standpoint, this chapter marks the first sustained tension between his public work and personal safety. The same Kingston that molded his discipline and audience also wrote different rules in that moment. He tightened his circle. He adjusted routes to venues. He linked with crews on site, rather than traveling as a visible unit. These are the practical details he emphasizes, the kind learned by artists working in environments where profile brings risk. He also identifies the start of a slower, interior turn here. It's not framed as a clean conversion or a sudden vow, but as a question that arrived and stayed. What does survival mean if it empties you? He describes brief visits to a church at the back, listening rather than performing. It's an early signal rather than a conclusion, and he does not rewrite the past to make the path look straight. The losses came close together in the mid-1990s. The first was Patrick. The next would follow. The changes that define his later life began, in his timeline, with the phone call on December 21st and the choices it forced. The professional ledger during this stretch is blunt. He kept his word on stages where he felt secure. He passed on sets where the risk outgrew the booking. He met audiences who wanted the old velocity and gave it to them, even as his offstage life grew narrower and more procedural. He distills the lesson with a working artist's economy. Borders remember, brands hesitate, fans still come. This opening chapter, by his own accounts, does not ask for sympathy as much as context. The decision to carry a weapon without a license is placed against a denied application, credible threats, and a family in shock. The consequences are not minimized. They shape his next decade. But he is clear about the why, and he locates the first signs of his eventual pivot in the same tight window. December 21st is the date he names. It is where he starts the after. Tower Street to Thompson Penn. Papa San's early years sit between two places that shaped him in different ways. Tower Street in Kingston put him near the hard edges of the city. Thompson Penn and De La Vega City in Spanish Town gave him the yard, the lane, and the sound of people who made a life with little. He talks about poverty as a backdrop, not a headline. Toys were made, not bought. A skater from scraps. A ball from whatever bounced. Friends filled the lane. The fun was real, even when money wasn't. That mix set his baseline. Make do, make it lively, and keep moving. Violence was not abstract in those years. He recalls political seasons that turned the street tense. Bodies and gunshot wounds were not rare. On Sundays, he remembers the hospital runs and the stretchers. That detail repeats in his telling because it captures the routine nature of it. Not spectacle. Routine. Death was something you had to navigate around to get through the week. The experience didn't make him numb. It made him alert. It taught him how fast a normal day could turn. It taught him how to read a corner before he stepped on it. Family structure for him was wide. He speaks of siblings on both his mother's and father's sides. A working father set the tone. The message was simple. Work is daily. Work is expected. That ethic is the through line to his later pace. Before he had a schedule, he knew what it felt like to get up and do what needed doing. His mother's steadiness and the extended family's near presence kept the house from drifting, even when the neighborhood pulled in different directions. Music was not a future plan in that house. It was a present fact. Turntable, 45s, the needle lift and scratch, and a weekly ritual when his father played records. He rattles off names like Lone Ranger because those voices were part of the room. The equipment mattered. The records were objects to be touched and learned. Pull the needle back. Drop it again. Know the groove by feel. That's a classroom for timing long before a stage is in sight. It gave him a physical relationship with sound. Not only lyrics. Mechanics. Mood. The way a bass line changes a room. The neighborhood circle overlapped with future names. He mentions Lady G as family from Thompson. Wolfman and Jonathan among the early peers. They were kids first. They were neighbors. They were not yet roles in a scene. That matters because it grounds the later titles. When he says they played skimmage in the lane, he is anchoring the relationships in a shared child world. The music came later. The trust came first. School was brief. He references Macaulay and leaving early for the road. Not because school had no value, but because the pull toward the sound life started young. The classroom lessons that stuck were practical. How to listen. How to watch. How to show respect to elders who owned the equipment or held the keys to a parlor. Those social codes become critical in any music scene. He learned them before he could name them. The city's split geography showed him contrasts. Kingston's pace. Spanish Town's community knots. Tower Street taught him edges. Thompson Penn taught him people. Both taught him to move with purpose and to avoid loud talk that draws the wrong eyes. He kept his head in a way that later made sense on stage. Watch the room. Feel the change before it hits. Adjust on the fly. That is survival training disguised as childhood. Poverty shows up in his memory in small, precise ways. The feel of a thin shoe. The way a meal stretches on a good week. The comfort of a neighbor who brings a plate when the house is short. He doesn't romanticize it. He doesn't wallow either. It's a ledger of facts. You learn humility because you need help sometimes. You learn pride because you fix what you can fix. You learn to keep the place tidy even when the paint is old. Those habits read as stage discipline later. Crisp start times. Tight sets. Clean delivery. The root is a house where pride showed in order, not things. Sunday hospital scenes deserve their own line because of how he returns to them. He describes stretchers, bodies, and gunshot wounds passing like traffic. That is environmental instruction. It tells a young mind what risk is. It tells him why people speak in low tones when certain names come up. It also tells him why joy is loud in safe moments. The street taught a narrow margin. The music became a place to widen it. The first real signal toward music as work is the turntable habit. He spent time lifting and dropping a needle. That is not a casual image. It reveals a kid training his ear for breaks and entrances. It's the difference between hearing a song and hearing structure. When he later stands on a sound system truck and anticipates a rhythm change, that timing comes from a childhood spent handling vinyl. The The father's weekly sessions gave him that building block. He remembers the crew of youths that moved together. Games in the lane. Errands. Shared jokes. Early nicknames. He places himself as fast and focused even then. Not loud for the sake of it. Loud when it served a point. That personality trait carries through. The later performance energy did not come from chasing attention. It came from clarity about what needed saying and how to say it tight. The political climate is not a deep dive in his telling, but it is always there. He notes tribal tension and the way neighborhoods align. He does not draw party lines in his narrative. He draws impact. Violence rises. People die. Families adapt with curfews of their own. That knowledge base explains a lot of his later decisions under pressure. He did not learn threat assessment as an adult. He learned it before he had a career. Religious exposure shows up as normal, not defining. Church as community. Prayers in hard weeks. Respect for elders who spoke in scripture when the street got hot. He parks those memories without forcing them into a neat arc. They sit there as seeds. Later, they matter. Here, they mark a household that had faith language even when money was short and danger was near. Work models came from more than his father. He mentions how the neighborhood took pride in hard labor. Market vendors. Mechanics. Bus drivers. Each with a routine. Each with a code. He absorbed that. Do what you say. Show up early. Don't break the tools. Those are simple lines with big effects later. It's why crews trusted him to run long sets without crashing the vibe. It's why promoters booked him repeatedly. The base was built at home. He does not make the early years about music scenes. He makes them about formation. The hours with records matter. The names of the artists matter. But the core is tone. How he learned to move through a place that could bless and break you in the same week. How he learned to carry loss when it came. How he learned to hold joy when it appeared. Friends who later became known artists are kept human. Lady G is a cousin figure and a lethal lyricist in the making. But in this chapter, she's a neighbor who came up in the same streets. Wolfman is a friend before he's a name. That framing protects the dignity of those relationships. It also keeps this chapter from borrowing shine from later achievements. The rule here is one-time placement of background. We place it now and won't repeat it later. He gives a straight line on poverty's double edge. It limited choices in some ways. It expanded resourcefulness in others. The lane taught barter, patience, and speed. The yard taught respect, jokes that cut tension, and what to do when an elder enters the space. He kept those lessons. The proof later is in how he handled big rooms without losing the yard tone. Fans felt seen because he kept the language tight and the posture humble. School's short run deserves clarity. He does not pretend he was built for a long classroom life. He says he left early. He also says the road was an education he was already taking. The point isn't to dismiss school. The point is to recognize where his gifts fit. Timing, memory, and breath control did not need a desk. They needed hours with a beat and a crowd. The seed planted here is the habit of daily practice. Not public. Private. Lines written, tested, tossed, and written again. That habit begins when he is still a boy. Family loss did not start in 1993 for the community around him. He grew up watching other families break. That context matters when he later speaks about grief with a steady tone. He had a vocabulary for it long before it hit his own house in the worst way. He learned to sit with people in their losses and say little. He learned to carry on with the day's tasks anyway. That is not coldness. It is a survival rhythm common in places where violence is frequent. If there is a single image that connects the boy to the man, it is the record player in a small home, the needle set in a groove, and a youth learning how to control sound with his hands. That is a picture of agency. In a world he couldn't control, here was a process he could master. Start and stop. Back and forward. Find the sweet spot where the voice drops in right. He chased that feeling across decades. It started here. Stereophonic schooling. The shift from a boy with a turntable habit to a working DJ began on small stages and moved fast toward sound system trucks. He points to talent shows around 1980 to 1981 as the first public proof. Those nights mattered because they tested breath, memory, and nerve in front of strangers who did not owe applause. He remembers winning one, placing second in another, and realizing the lane voice could hold a room. A man named Calvin saw enough to pull him toward a bigger classroom. Stereophonic. Stereophonic was not a soft landing. It was a training ground with long hours and hard ears. The format forced growth. Dances could run from 9 at night to 3 or 4 in the morning. A DJ who came with 2 lyrics would die after midnight. He talks about writing like sport. Lines every day. Variations on speed and pattern. New punch lines that could answer any surprise. The target was stamina with clarity. Speed without blur. He built that on weekday afternoons and proved it on weekend nights. His first clashes set the tone. He names Arrows Liberty and Shamba as the first two he rubbed out, a phrase that recurs when he maps the period. The claim is not chest beating. It is a marker of confidence gained early under pressure. Those events taught him how to turn a crowd without hiding behind a dubplate or a prearranged order. Pawn for pawn, microphone to microphone, he learned to read a rival's breath and step into the gap with a line that landed quick and clean. The commute from Spanish Town into Kingston for those dances shaped his work ethic. He rode buses with notebooks, wrote standing up, and used dawn rides home to test internal timing. The practicalities were a curriculum. Keep your gear simple. Keep your lines sorted. Sleep in pieces and don't miss call time. Many DJs went through versions of this routine, but for him the combination of speed training and long sets created a specialty that crowds recognized early. The stereophonic crew gave him space and pressure. The selectors needed DJs who could carry a segment. He became that. Apprenticeship turned into frontline duty. He talks about learning to build a section, not only ride one rhythm with one fast idea. He would set an opening line tight, extend into a second layer with a new angle, and close a section with a hook the crowd could chant. That structure later became a signature on bigger sounds. He describes the difference between practicing fast talk and executing it live. At home, a tongue twister can impress in a mirror. In a dance at 1 a.m., it must cut through a sound system, reach the back fence, and land on beat without slur. He built the muscle to keep consonants crisp at pace. He also learned restraint. Speed is not a blanket. It is a blade used when it serves the line. In slower pockets, he would settle, set a trap, then spring the sprint at the right bar. The atmosphere in those early stereophonic nights was competitive, but not chaotic. The crew expected punctuality and form. The elders held the space. He learned how to enter, greet, test the mic, and roll without fuss. The audience knew the difference between an artist who respected the platform and one who treated it loose. He built trust with them by staying ready. If a selector pulled a quick change, he did not blink. He locked to the new rhythm and pushed forward. He marks a personal shift in this period. At first, speed was a talent. By the end of the stereophonic apprenticeship, it was a tool in a wider kit. He had built catalogs by theme, social commentary, witty clash bars, party lifts, and reality check lines that could quiet a corner before building it back. That range kept him from becoming a novelty act. It also set him up to lead when the chance came. The first taste of leadership came as stereophonic leaned on him more often. He stepped into longer runs. He managed transitions between DJs. He guided the energy and paced the night. Those responsibilities moved him from a hungry youth to a reliable name. The crowd started to arrive expecting him. That changes a performer's relationship with risk. He learned to keep a reserve of fresh lines for the late segment when fatigue hits and rivals get sloppy. He credits the stereophonic nights with giving him clarity about the difference between a sound winning a clash with dubplates and a DJ winning a segment with lyrics. He would later return to that distinction whenever people blurred categories. The lesson started here. When the selector's box is quiet and it is only voice against voice, the man with air control, clean diction, and a live brain wins. He trained for that exact contest, night after night. The bus rides carried another layer of education. He observed how ordinary Jamaicans talked, joked, and argued. He folded those rhythms into his lines. It kept his work grounded. He could be rapid and still sound like a neighbor. That tone made him dangerous in clashes. He wasn't performing a character. He was compressing everyday speech into a tight form that hit quick. People felt seen and entertained at once. There is a practical humility in how he describes the grind. He does not present stereophonic as a glamorous stage. It was work. Long hours, rough travel, pay that did not match the energy spent, but he frames it as the essential school. Without those months and years, he would not have had the lungs or the catalog for what came later at Lee's Unlimited and beyond. The training solved a problem. How to keep a crowd from 9 p.m. to near dawn without repeating oneself or losing edge. He talks about memory as a muscle. He built systems to file lines in his head by theme and rhythm compatibility. He could slot a punch line into different beats and keep the accent correct. He drilled that. It made him versatile. It also made him a hard target. Rivals could not predict exactly which line or which pattern would come next. That unpredictability created a kind of psychological edge in live tests. Stereophonic also placed him in the same orbit as established names who passed through or listened from the side. He learned when to step forward and when to stand down. He absorbed quiet advice from elders who did not need to announce themselves. The lesson was consistency. Be the same level of sharp on a slow Wednesday as on a big Saturday. Promoters notice. Crews notice. So do rivals. The early clashes with Arrow's Liberty and Shamba left a mark because they confirmed to him that the style worked under fire. He was not only a studio voice or a rehearsal miracle. He could take heat and send it back. That confidence made the next steps possible. It also set expectations. Once a man shows he can end a segment, the room will demand that kill again and again. He had to balance that pressure with the need to keep evolving, so the kill never looked recycled. There were practical setbacks. Equipment failures. Late transport. Nights where the crowd took time to warm. He frames those as part of the tuition. He learned to reset a room by dropping into a different pocket. He learned to laugh at a glitch and use it as a line. He learned to protect his throat across multiple nights by warming up quietly and hydrating at smart intervals. These are the unglamorous skills that keep a career from burning out early. The stereophonic period also shaped his sense of fairness in a dance. He respected rivals who came clean with lyrics and timing. He looked down on tactics that ducked the test. That code later informed how he talks about the difference between sound system victories and artist-to-artist contests. The seed of that philosophy is planted here in the hours where only voice and crowd decide a round. He traces a straight line from this school to his later ability to lead at creation. Leadership is not a switch you throw when a sound hands you a mic. It is a set of habits you have already built. Keep the set list in your head while listening for cues from the selector. Keep an eye on security and the edges of the crowd. Keep a reserve to close hard if the night needs it. He learned all of that when nobody knew his name beyond a few parishes. Another key element he developed here is composure under interruption. In outdoor dances, disturbances happen. A fight breaks on the far side. A power dip cuts a bar. A rival interjects. He trained himself to hold the moment and return with a line that named the break without feeding it. That balance kept crowds with him and kept situations from escalating. It also made selectors trust him with sensitive segments. He is clear that the stereophonic truck taught him logistics. Arrive with the crew, set the area, keep cables tidy, know your exits. He treated setup as part of performance. That respect for the whole operation endeared him to people who ran the gear. In Jamaican music, the people who drive and wire the sound hold quiet power. He earned their respect early and kept it, which later paid dividends when he needed favors or quick fixes. He also built an ethic around not wasting lines. If a pun or a punch landed once, he would file it and retire it for a while. He saved duplication for specific callback moments. That habit aligns with the no-overlap rule in this project. It started as a survival tactic in long nights. Freshness wins. Stereophonic gave him a small measure of fame in pockets. People started to know his face and his voice. But he remained mobile. He did not build an identity on one corner. That mobility helped when he stepped to other sounds later. He was not woven so tight into one brand that he could not adapt. The portability of his voice and set discipline made him a natural fit for rooms he had never seen. There is a small set of names he drops as early peers with whom he shared these stages. Some went on to different lanes. Some stayed local. He frames them with respect. The point isn't the roll call. The point is the culture. A generation learning in public spaces where failure is loud and success is loud. He survived that and learned to thrive in it. The process burned away softness and left a performer who could take pressure without folding. He says the main lesson from Stereophonic was clarity. Know who you are on a mic. He was not a crooner. He was not a pure comedian. He was a precision rapper in Jamaican cadence with an ear for crowd psychology. Once he accepted that identity and built around it, his work sharpened. The next platforms would test it at higher stakes. But the core was built here. By the end of this chapter's period, he had moved from promising to proven in the eyes of people who mattered in that world. The doors to bigger sounds opened. the invitations to lead sets came. The leap to Lee's Unlimited, and then to creation would follow. He did not skip steps. He took them in full stride, carrying the habits and the catalog that Stereophonic forced him to build. The boy with the needle on the 45 had turned into a DJ who could hold a night. The city knew his timing. He was ready for the next rung. Lee's creation and the general. When the calls came from Lee's Unlimited, they weren't casual invitations. Lee's had a reputation for order and for results. Entering that circle meant stepping into a machine that expected wins and measured nights and outcomes. Papa San's move into Lee's signaled that his Stereophonic schooling had done more than sharpen speed. It had made him reliable. Lee's needed someone who could hold a center, close a segment, and turn a room when the temperature dipped. He fit the job. At Lee's, he experienced a different kind of pressure. This wasn't the scrappy proving ground of an emerging youth. This was a brand with standing. The sounds following expected dominance, not effort. The bar was sound of the year level, night after night. He describes this phase as one where professionalism and craft merged. Set times had to be honored. Transitions had to be crisp. Internal discipline mattered as much as external fire. He handled that shift by applying the same habits he built at Stereophonic. Early arrival, quiet prep, a mind for structure, and a reserve of lines to deploy late when fatigue set in across the park. He credits Lee's with teaching him the politics of placement. Who opens? Who anchors? When to risk a new routine? When to revert to a proven run? He also learned to think at the scale of a sound, not only a single DJ. That meant carrying themes across an evening, allowing space for singers and other DJs to land clean, and reading the selector's box like a second script. Under that system, he became a central driver, but he also became a better teammate. A rising set lifts everyone if paced right. He treated the job that way. The leap to creation came as a step from anchor to leader. Creation needed a lead voice that could impose shape and fend off rivals across varied conditions. In his telling, creation was a battleground where skills met strategy. He was no longer a strong piece on the board. He was the one moving pieces and deciding the attack. The pressure changed again. He responded by deepening his catalog and sharpening his understanding of how a crowd breathes through the phases of a long dance. Creation's identity under his lead hinged on a simple promise. If the knight turns to pawn for pawn, they would not be found short. He draws a clear line between two kinds of victories that often get blurred in public talk. One is a sound system when powered by dubplates, selections, and sound effects. The other is an artist-to-artist contest decided by live lyrics and immediate crowd response. He respects both arenas, but refuses to mix them. In his code, a dub-led win doesn't prove lyrical superiority, and a lyrical kill doesn't erase the importance of a deep dub box. Creation, in his era, tried to carry both, but he stakes his personal reputation on the pawn-for-pawn fights. The most testing nights, by his account, came against Black Scorpio, where General Trees stood as the principal rival. He calls Trees the hardest challenge because of voice, timing, and the tactical use of counteraction. Trees didn't always need volume. He would lower tone, pick a line that turned a previous punch inside out, and hand the crowd a frame to hear the next minutes through. That is a high craft. It forced Papa San to refine his own approach. Speed alone wouldn't do it. He had to sequence ideas, land a clean image, and then at pace, deliver closure on a point before Trees could pry it open again. He reaches for a single word to describe Trees in that window. Pepper. It captures the sting and the after effect. Their exchanges, especially in places like Skateland, had that back-and-forth quality where neither side could settle into safety. When he speaks about those nights, he emphasizes balance. Each camp had a crowd. Each camp had a case. The decision often rested on minute shifts. Who caught a breath wrong, who chose the better angle on a trending reference, who left space for a chant to lift at the right bar. Spanish Town, Brunswick Avenue, holds a place in his memory as a site of decisive creation nights. He narrates the atmosphere as one where his own people pressed close and demanded a clean display. Familiar ground can help or hurt. He treated it as an obligation to be sharper, not louder. The point wasn't noise. It was clarity. Under streetlights and on truck decks, he walked through sets that kept rivals on the back foot and the audience forward. Those are the nights he points to when people ask him where creation proved itself under his voice. One of the milestone contests he cites is Creation versus Ninja Man in 1989. He frames it as a done result, a walkover, and moves on. He doesn't linger on play-by-plays. He uses it as shorthand for a period where his efficiency in live test situations produced outcomes that the street remembers without extensive retelling. When pressed about other contested nights in later interviews, he tends to fall back on two shields: the distinction between sound-led and lyric-led wins, and a refusal to relitigate results beyond what he and his peers already know. Inside Creation, he built a lyric camp culture. Younger voices came through to sharpen, learn placement, and understand the code. Lecturer appears as a name he highlights for pen discipline and for the internal standard they tried to maintain. Mentorship here wasn't classroom chalk and board. It was shared practice on trucks, in yards, and at quick link-ups before a night run. He taught catalog building, breath control at speed, and how to take a counteraction without losing composure. The method was simple: set your structure, don't chase, and answer clean. He also explains how Creation, while building an artist-first reputation, worked within a broader sound circuit. When other sounds wanted a lyrical kill for a specific clash night, he would freelance onto those decks and deliver. African Symbol and Cosmic Force appear as platforms where he stepped in to do specialist work. Those engagements weren't disloyalty. They were expressions of a DJ economy where a distinctive skill set could be contracted to tip a balance. He made those runs count without diluting Creation's profile. The Scorpio matches with General Trees are the centerpiece of this period because they forced technical refinement. Counteraction, when done well, takes a line the crowd enjoyed and flips its sense without sounding bitter or defensive. To beat that, a DJ must be ahead on ideas and flexible on order. Papa San adjusted by carrying multiple exits to any section. If a pivot became necessary mid-bar, he could dock one idea and pull a prepared parallel without losing rhythm. That is a non-trivial skill. It relies on preloaded language structures and a mind trained to select under pressure. He is emphatic that Creation in his time didn't lean on soft advantages. The claim is that when the segment turned into pure lyrics, they held their ground against anyone, and often better than that. He talks about nuanced metrics that matter in the ring but get lost in later folklore. The crowd's oxygen level after a line, the survival of a chant beyond two bars, and the time it takes a rival to re-enter after taking a hit. He measured those things. They made sense to him in the moment, and later became signs he could use to judge a night without the haze of hype. At the same time, he narrates internal discipline within Creation. A lyrical camp can become loose if it begins to believe its own myth. He kept drills in place. New lines had to be tested. Old lines rested to avoid staleness. The camp had rules about not scoring cheap points that invited escalation off stage. He understood the thin membrane between show and street. He worked to keep it intact. There's also a record of friendly spar sessions with Stitchy and others, separate from Creation's flagship contests. He frames those as a season where rivalry was a sport and also a business. The ability to clash friendly on a TV commercial set or a corporate event without tearing the fabric of the scene was part of the job. He mentions early TV ad appearances as proof that he could bring the same precision to a sanitized stage without losing edge. That versatility mattered because it carried him into the early 1990s, where corporate visibility began to intersect with dancehall presence more often. He remains blunt about nights when sounds with massive dub boxes could win a clash without any DJ proving much. If a four-sound juggle leans heavy on exclusive cuts and technical tricks, lyrical contests may not decide the result. He refuses to count those as evidence of any artist's superiority. That perspective was formed here and repeated later to correct what he sees as category errors in fan debates. Under his lead, Creation's brand in the late 1980s was not only aggression. It was control. They would step into a space, set a tone, enforce pace, and avoid getting dragged into a format that didn't suit the moment. He values control because it keeps crews safe, protects promoters' nights, and most importantly, lets the audience get what they came for without spillover. That operational mindset is an often overlooked part of why certain sounds rise and hold a tier for a time. General Trees remains the rival he salutes most. Respect runs through his references. Trees brought a full toolkit, a distinctive voice, a calm that read as confidence, and the intelligence to turn a line into a frame. Facing that repeatedly honed his own edges. He says those nights made him better and kept the scene honest. When fans later ask who could go toe-to-toe with him, he doesn't dodge the name. He calls it straight. He also hints at the emotional tax of living at that speed. Running creation at peak intensity meant long cycles with few true off days. The writing never stopped. The preparation never stopped. The public expectation never dipped. He had to protect his voice, his sleep, and his patience in environments not built to support any of those. He did it because he loved the work and because he knew he was made for that exact contest. But he recognizes in hindsight that those years also set a rhythm that would be hard to break when life demanded a different tempo. Within this chapter's frame, the map is clear. Lee's Unlimited refined his professionalism and taught him to think like a sound. Creation elevated him to leadership in the exact contest he valued most, lyric-led tests in live rooms. Scorpio and General Trees pushed him to his limits and kept the craft honest. Spanish Town gave him a ground where his authority read as earned. Ninja Man at 1989 marked an era line. Mentorship and freelance specialist runs rounded out a period where his name meant both speed and structure. He will not argue minute details of results in public forums now. He offers a principle instead. Count the pawn for pawn knights. Watch the crowd at the decisive lines. Remember who kept control. If you measure by those standards, he believes his record at creation stands where he places it. Whether a listener agrees or not, the internal coherence of his account is strong. He explains the criteria, distinguishes the categories, and holds to a code. By the close of this phase, he had proven everything a DJ of his type could prove in the arena that mattered to him. The next act would move into studios, videos, and a different kind of audience where MTV sets and international contracts replaced truck decks and parish fields. The logic of his career demanded the move. The skills he built at Stereophonic, Lee's, and Creation would travel with him. The code would too. MTV rotation. By the late 1980s, Papa San's live authority had already been stamped in parish fields and city hubs. What came next was a shift in platform, not in identity. The studio catalog thickened. The videos arrived. International eyes opened. He traces that arc through a set of clear markers. Early singles that proved recording power, a run of chart dominance, an international contract that widened reach, and a video era that put a fast-talking DJ in front of MTV viewers who weren't used to that level of velocity in Jamaican cadence. He anchors the recorded timeline with Animal Party in 1984. It became the first breakthrough record after years of pure sound system grind. Then the long march to 1988 delivered momentum in bulk. He recalls releasing a cluster of tunes in a tight window, with multiple cuts climbing and at least two number ones tied to combinations with Lady G. Roundtable Talk is central in his memory of that run. The pairing showcased a conversational chemistry and a structural trick he'd been sharpening live: call, response, switch of angle, and close. He carried that into the booth and onto radio with the same economy that served him in clashes. The period that followed 1988 fused stage and chart. In 1989, he points to a DJ of the Year honor and a presence that made bookings, radio spins, and tape dubs reinforce each other. The studio work was not a detour from his core skill. It was an extension. He translated speed into recorded clarity by tightening syllable choices and spacing punchlines so they could survive the mix, play on radio without smearing, and still feel live. That balance made the records move. Crucial to this chapter is the way combinations broaden the audience. Lady G appears again as a key partner. Their records didn't only celebrate wit. They also offered a gendered balance that made party sets and radio segments land across demographics. Elsewhere, he balanced solo pieces with features that folded singers into his frame. He speaks about Strange, I Will Survive, My Name Is, and other titles as snapshots of a peak where the release schedule stayed hot and the public appetite matched it. He keeps the discussion grounded. The impact was measurable because the songs lived in the street, on the radio, and on stage at the same time. Then came the formal pivot into international markets through a contract he places around 1991. He describes it as his first major overseas deal, the one that put his videos into MTV rotation and took him into media spaces that Jamaican DJs of his stripe rarely entered at that moment. He names U.S. hip-hop figures who appeared in or around those visuals and sets, pointing to cross-pollination that felt natural to him. The speed he brought had cousins in U.S. rap traditions, and performers like Dougie Fresh and later Busta Rhymes recognized the shared terrain. Those encounters didn't change his template. They validated the portability of the style. The MTV era mattered for more than visibility. It required production discipline. A video shoot demands a different timing than a live segment. Hits must read in 3 minutes with a visual logic that amplifies, not distracts. He adapted by simplifying some of his most dense runs on record, while preserving the edge that made the brand. The result was a set of videos and edits that brought the energy of a Jamaican dance to screens around the world without losing clarity. There's a business subplot that runs under these gains. He talks openly about the learning curve around contracts, publishing, and royalties. He says he began to understand the formal business more fully around 1990, which means early releases could be trapped in deals that didn't favor him. He recalls seeing records pressed and on shelves in Europe without his prior knowledge, a reminder of how rights and releases moved in that era. He doesn't dramatize it. He logs it as an artist's education in a shifting industry. Later, with better counsel, he would navigate with more leverage, but the early 90s included misalignments that cost. One anecdote he revisits involves interest from a larger US label that would have required a buyout from the existing deal. The number quoted to release him was, in his telling, a hard wall. He frames that as a fork in the road where a different path was closed not by lack of audience, but by the structure of paperwork. The point is not grievance. It is the reality of how contracts can fix or freeze a career's direction, even when demand is strong. The value of the international deal he did sign is clear in his memory. He credits it with placing him on channels and in markets where his voice could be heard beyond diaspora hubs. The image matters. A Jamaican DJ delivering at speed on mainstream US music television. That sequence helped widen the lane for others and built a template for how a stage-hardened artist could move into media without losing core identity. In parallel, the studio catalogs rolled forward. He singles out an album he regards as the most effective internationally in that window, tied to the video cycle and the contracts push. The title sits in his mind as proof that the package, songs, visuals, and distribution work together. He balances that by noting that Jamaica's DJ culture still thrived on singles. Albums gave a spine to a narrative and a touring cycle. Singles kept the name hot in every corner. He did both, knowing that a tune could chart and a B-side could run the dances. He outlines a pattern of wins that allowed him to hold multiple chart positions at once. He mentions having two number ones alongside number twos, an arrangement that underlines how often he kept the release schedule loaded. The lesson he draws is practical. Volume matters if quality holds, because it keeps the conversation centered on your voice. That strategy, built on live stamina, carried into record output. Corporate visibility intersects with this chapter as well. He references early TV commercials alongside other prominent artists. Those appearances confirmed that he could modulate tone for brand frameworks while staying himself. It also meant the music bled into households beyond core fans, setting up a broader base for tours and festival placements as the 1990s progressed. The crossover dialogue with US hip-hop wasn't only about exposure. It was a mutual acknowledgement of technique. He points to conversations and stage moments with figures who valued speed, crowd control, and breath as a sport. He didn't present himself as an import. He stood as a peer from a parallel tradition. That positioning mattered in booking rooms where authenticity and command were the currencies that counted beyond trend. Touring widened with the media footprint. He carried the new records into rooms far from Kingston and Spanish Town and learned to translate the dance energy for venues with different acoustics and crowd habits. He carried the same tight sets and the same rule about not wasting lines. The discipline resolved across geographies. In that sense, MTV was not just a channel. It was a catalyst that made the live show global. Throughout, he kept a distinction that shows up whenever he is asked to rank successes. A televised rotation, a chart run, and a slam dance are different wins that feed each other. He counts them separately and resists flattening them into one graph. That analytic habit, formed in sound system accounting, helped him avoid chasing one metric at the expense of the others. He kept the triangle in view: street, media, and stage. He also makes space for the cost of that pace. The release pressure, the video schedules, and the travel load stack on a body that already spent years on trucks and late nights. He doesn't glamorize the grind. He notes the need for sleep discipline, voice care, and a small circle that can manage logistics cleanly so the artist can arrive focused. Those are the invisible supports behind a period that, on the surface, reads as nonstop ascent. The larger story of this chapter is not a conversion narrative or a personal crisis. It's a professional consolidation and expansion. A DJ who mastered live tests turned that mastery into record success and visual presence without losing the core of the performance style. The speed stayed. The diction stayed. The writing stayed tight. The platforms multiplied. The business knowledge lagged early, then caught up. Doors opened that set him on stages with artists from neighboring traditions who recognized the craft. By the end of this period, his name carried weight in both grassroots and corporate spaces. He had proven that a Jamaican fast-talking DJ could occupy prime media slots and sell records without sanding off the edges that made the voice distinct. The next phase would test how that professional trajectory survives personal shocks. The murder of his brother in late 1993 and the string of losses and consequences that followed belong to the next chapter. Here, the record stands, hits logged, videos aired, contracts signed, and a performance language translated to screens without losing its source. Losses and a line in the sand. The professional climb that carried Papa San into the early 1990s met a hard break in late 1993. The murder of his brother Patrick on December 21st sits at the center of his personal timeline and shapes everything that follows in this phase. He speaks about it as a before and after marker. The detail is not presented for shock. It is the frame for decisions that followed under credible threat and profound grief. In the immediate aftermath, warnings were direct. Friends and family urged him to avoid an upcoming Fort Clarence date. He notes that people told him eyes were on his movements. His mother-in-law asked him to stay home. He had tried to take a legal route for self-protection before the killing. He trained, did range time, filed the paperwork, and was denied a firearm license. After Patrick's death and the threats that came with it, he chose to carry without a license. He characterizes that decision as survival, not image. It was about moving from car to door and getting through the night. The consequences were fast and measurable. A criminal record meant border trouble. He recounts being turned away from Grand Cayman for 5 years. He also mentions being processed through secondary rooms in Canada because of the police record. Corporate confidence slipped. A Pepsi commercial fell through. Management could not front an artist whose name had taken that legal hit. The bookings did not disappear. The demand stayed. But the business around him changed tone. Promoters asked new questions. Security planning became part of every conversation. He adapted to that environment with tighter circles, altered routes, and stricter timing. He describes the immediate months as a double life. On stage, the set stayed sharp. Off stage, the administrative drag grew heavier. Paperwork, questions, and the quiet stigma of a record followed him through airports and offices. He does not embellish this. He logs it. The world reads a file before it reads a face. He worked through it without public complaint, but he acknowledges the strain. The period did not deliver only one loss. He places his sister's death soon after Patrick's, in a car crash following a match at Harborview. The proximity of the two events gives this chapter its weight. He says he never recovered from the first loss before the second arrived. Grief compounded. The senselessness of a street murder linked to the randomness of a traffic accident. The family absorbed both blows. He kept working because work was what he knew, but he does not hide the cost. He points to a season where the stage became a place to breathe, and offstage hours were narrow. Threat assessment became a daily practice. He refined simple rules. Switch routes, link crews at venues rather than travel as a visible convoy, leave shows on time, and avoid after events where control fades. He applied those rules quietly. He did not build an image around them. The aim was to lower risk while maintaining commitments. That operational stance fit the discipline he learned in the sound system world. Control the factors you can. Step away when the variables multiply. He acknowledges missteps. Carrying a weapon without a license brought outcomes he predicted and accepted. He says he measured the choice against immediate survival needs. He also holds that the license denial, after a legitimate application and training, removed a safeguard that could have kept him on a sanctioned path. That context matters to him. It does not erase the legal reality. It explains the logic under pressure. The brand hit that followed is part of the record. Corporate partners prefer clean files. Even if a product wants the energy of dance hall, legal exposure is a line many won't cross. He cites the Pepsi opportunity to make the point. It is an example of how a single decision under threat can ripple into rooms far from the street where that decision was made. He does not complain about the preference. He notes it as a fact in the ledger. Travel constraints did more than bruise ego. They limited revenue and reach. being blocked from Grand Cayman for 5 years meant a steady stream of bookings was not available. Secondary holds in Canada slowed movement and added stress to tours that required tight connections and focus. He adapted by staying early, carrying paperwork in order, and working with teams who could anticipate the questions that came with his file. The practical adjustments kept the machine running, but they cost time and calm. This period also tested his relationship with community visibility. He had built fame on being present in dances, markets, and schools. Now presence carried risk. He reduced spontaneous appearances and increased planned engagements with proper security and clean exits. Fans still found him, and he still delivered. But he drew a line around private time and family space. That adjustment is common among artists who cross a certain threshold of attention in volatile contexts. He names it without apology. The creative output did not stop. He emphasizes that fans kept coming and chanting. He kept sets tight and gave them the voice they knew. Yet the content axis started to tilt. He began writing more reflective lines, even if they were not always the ones he recorded or performed in the heat of a night. He calls it the beginning of a quiet turn, not a public declaration, a private draft of a different future. He ties the first steps of his faith transition to this window, but he does not romanticize it. He speaks of sitting at the back of a church, listening rather than speaking. He frames it as a search for a peace that did not require legal jeopardy or constant vigilance. The decision to choose a different life did not land in one service. It arrived over months where loss made him ask questions he had avoided in the peak years. What does survival cost when measured against the rest of a life? What kind of stage leaves a man whole at the end of the night? He gives credit to family voices who encouraged the shift. Mothers and elders who knew scripture and knew him. They did not force a timeline. They made room. He also gives respect to industry mentors who supported the idea that an artist could change lanes without erasing the past. That permission matters in cultures where identity can be policed by nostalgia. He found enough room to consider another route. From a business perspective, the period demanded damage control. He and his team pursued what could be cleaned on paper, maintained relationships that understood context, and accepted that some doors would stay closed. He kept the focus on consistent delivery where he was booked. Every fulfilled date was a counterweight to rumor. Every professional night was evidence that the man and the machine still ran clean on stage, even if the file said otherwise off stage. He returns often to the difference between spectacle and reality. Fans and media can fixate on the moment of a clash or a headline. He wants the record to hold the slow grind of consequences and adjustments that followed. This chapter is built on those slow realities. It situates a series of personal tragedies and practical decisions inside a working life that did not pause but did change shape. He also insists on honesty about cause and effect. The decision to carry illegally was his. The license denial was the state's. The threats were from unnamed actors in a tense environment. The combination created a pressure cooker where every option cost. He chose the option that, in his calculus, protected life first. The system answered with a record. The market answered with caution. He continued anyway. By the mid-1990s, he was living at an inflection point. The touring map narrowed, but did not vanish. The reputation remained strong with crowds who valued the work. The corporate sheen faded. The music industry's center of gravity was shifting globally, and dance hall would soon face a new wave of voices and styles. Within that larger change, his internal shift gained speed. He began to plan an exit from the lane that made him. Not as a retreat, but as a redefinition. He frames the coming transition as a move toward a platform where his voice could still carry, where discipline would still count, and where the ledger would favor restoration over attrition. He did not announce this as a press strategy. He lived into it. The losses created the space for the question. The consequences kept the question in view. The faith language he knew from childhood offered a vocabulary for answers. This chapter belongs to the years where the balance between public momentum and private fallout became impossible to ignore. It documents the specific losses, the legal consequences, the travel restrictions, the brand shifts, and the beginnings of a spiritual turn. It stays inside those boundaries because the next chapter will take up the transition fully. Here, the line in the sand is clear. He would not live inside permanent threat management as a way of life. He would not make a record his permanent shadow. He would finish his commitments with care, protect his family, and stepped toward a stage that did not ask him to trade safety for presence. The story does not present him as a victim or a hero in these years. It presents a working artist navigating a compressed series of blows and the systems that respond to them. It shows the math behind a choice many outside the context might judge quickly. It places that math against a man's obligations to his family and to himself. In that sense, this is not a detour from his career. It is the central pivot that explains why the next act looks the way it does. By the end of this stretch, the outlines of that next act are visible. The church pew in the back becomes a regular seat. The notebook holds lines that will not fit on old rhythms. The phone still rings, but different voices start to matter more. He begins to see a road out that is not a hiding place, but a new assignment. The sound system soldier who trained for years to win pawn for pawn is preparing to fight on a different front, with the same breath, the same timing, and a new aim. From sound to sanctuary. The transition did not arrive as a press conference. It grew in the spaces between shows, in quiet rooms, and in the long exhale after years of holding a crowd. Papa San describes the late 1990s as the period when he began to reassign the same discipline that made him a force in dance hall to a different platform. The choice came from lived pressure, not a branding exercise. He had run the full circuit: Parrish Fields, Skateland, Brunswick Avenue, Sting Nights, chart runs, international contracts, and TV spots. After the losses and the legal fallout, he looked for a life that could carry weight and still return him to himself. Faith was not new to his story. It lived in his childhood house as prayer, language, and respect for elders who carried scripture. In this period, faith moved from background to frame. He began to sit in church deliberately, not as a guest but as a listener. He did not rush a conversion story. He built a new habit: attendance, reflection, a tightening of the circle around voices that spoke restoration rather than only survival. He puts it plainly now: I'm not that person anymore. The line signals a shift in identity that does not disown the past. It closes one assignment and accepts another. The practical work of a new lane started like any other career phase he respected. With training, breath, timing, and diction were already honed. What needed reshaping was content and arrangement. He turned the same efficiency on a different message. Hook placement changed. Cadence flexed to fit congregational spaces and gospel stages. He kept the clarity that made him legible in noisy outdoor nights and applied it to rooms where the aim is conviction rather than conquest. Touring did not stop. It pivoted. He names Africa as a memory marker, with a show at the Nile Hotel grounds where the reaction proved how far the catalog had traveled and how ready audiences were to meet him in a new register. He points to Peru as another anchor, a stadium date that confirmed the global reach built in the earlier era. Japan and Switzerland appear in the map as stops where the technique translated across language lines because delivery and structure remain universal. These stories are not detours. They demonstrate that platform change did not erase demand. It redirected it. Mentorship grew from the same impulse that once made him build a lyric camp at Creation. In the new chapter, the emphasis moved from sharpening clash bars to shaping lives and craft with guardrails. He references lecturer and others from his earlier circle with respect and brings that ethic forward. Teach placement, insist on discipline, tell the truth about the business, and place safety and integrity above spectacle. In the faith lane, that meant preparing younger voices to hold a stage without the shortcuts that burn out careers or harm communities. He keeps his code about the past. Asked to rank old clashes or relitigate historic nights, he declines. He repeats the core distinctions that guided his career, pawn for pawn versus doubled, and leaves it there. The refusal is not disdain. It is boundary. He will honor the work and the craft. He will not live in arguments that no longer define his purpose. The statement, "I love Jesus, but I can speak truth," summarizes that stance. It's not a performance line. It is a working rule. Tell the truth about what happened. Refuse the bait to inflame. Keep moving. The studio side of the new phase required rebuilding networks. Distribution, radio, and stage circuits differ between secular dance hall and gospel. He navigated those differences by leaning on professionalism that promoters recognize regardless of genre. Arrive early, deliver tight, respect time, keep the band sharp, and leave the venue as clean as you found it. The reputation he earned for reliability traveled with him and opened doors that ideology alone would not. He also learned to guard voice and time more carefully. The earlier machine ran on relentless output and constant presence. The new assignment needed sustainable pacing. He set boundaries around travel, rest, and family. That change is visible in how he describes his weeks. Built around services, recording sessions with a clear plan, and selective touring that honors both ministry commitments and health. The audience still gets energy. It is no longer drawn down from emergency reserves. The catalog in this phase extends his core strengths. He still writes for the ear first. He still believes in short lines that carry weight. He retains the habit of not repeating a punch unless a callback serves a moment. He avoids jargon and remains conversational. The difference is aim. Where earlier bars aim to dominate a room, newer lines aim to steady it. The breath that once sprinted to land a kill now runs to carry a testimony. The technique did not soften. It found a new job. Community work grew alongside music. He plugged into networks that addressed the same street realities that shaped him. Violence, youth drift, and the thin margin families live on remain present. He approaches them with the credibility of someone who survived those conditions publicly and privately. He does not promise quick fixes. He offers principles that held under stress: consistency, honesty about consequences, and respect for the people who keep homes standing with scarce resources. He keeps the old crew relationships human. He speaks of Lady G, Wolfman, and others as people first. He honors their paths without forcing them into his narrative. He refuses to narrate their choices or sell a conversion story by contrasting his arc with theirs. That restraint protects the dignity of the culture that produced him and lets his own story stand on its merits. International audiences in this phase respond to the same elements that worked before: clarity, control, and timing. He knows how to handle a room. He knows when to raise pace and when to hold. He still builds sections as a sequence: open, extend, close, so that listeners are never stranded in a mood or a message. That craft keeps sets from becoming sermons without shape or concerts without spine. It also keeps him present as a narrator, not only a preacher. He maintains transparency about the costs he paid and the choices he made. He does not rewrite the record to erase the weapon charge or the border holds. He places them as events inside a larger story of redirection. That honesty gives him standing to speak to younger artists facing versions of the same pressures. He can say what a file will do to a life. He can explain how a single decision under fear can echo for years. He can also show how consistent professional conduct can offset stigma over time, if not erase it. Legacy is not a word he leans on, but it is the right lens here. The first half of his public life demonstrated what focused technique and discipline can achieve in a contested cultural space. The second half demonstrates how that same focus can be repurposed to build, repair, and guide. The through line is respect for the audience. In both lanes, he refuses to condescend. He assumes listeners are smart, that they hear structure, and that they respond to truth told clean. The sound system era remains part of his identity, not as a nostalgia loop, but as a source of tools. Stagecraft, breath, catalog, and crowd reading are transferable assets. He teaches that transfer. He shows that a DJ trained to survive Skateland can run a global ministry calendar and deliver with the same precision. The difference is the end he points to. The metrics shift from kills and charts to steadiness and reach. There are images he carries from this phase that mirror earlier ones. Where there once was a truck deck under streetlights, there is now a church stage with a band set to lift a room. Where there once were dubplates stamped with his name, there are now songs aimed at healing rather than heat. Where there once were after-event link-ups, there are now counseling moments and small conversations after a service. The energy is not smaller. It is directed. He leaves a set of simple rules behind him for those watching the arc. Hold your corner with dignity, respect the work, refuse shortcuts that cost your future, write daily, and keep your voice clear. If the lane changes, bring the craft with you. Do not apologize for growth. Do not throw away the discipline that got you here. If you speak truth about your past and honor those who shared it, your next assignment will not feel like a betrayal. It will feel like continuity. In this final chapter of the series, the portrait resolves. A youth from Tower Street and Thompson Penn learned timing on a turntable, built stamina on trucks, led creation in nights that still echo in people's talk, translated style to records and videos that ran in heavy rotation, absorbed losses that reordered his priorities, faced consequences that closed certain doors, and chose a path that let his voice do a different kind of work. The breath is the same. The diction is the same. The mind for structure is the same. The mission changed. He declines to pretend that the old contests mean nothing. They meant a lot. They made him. He also declines to perform the past as a party trick for cameras. He stands in the present with a clear aim and looks forward. The story ends without a bow. It ends with a working artist, now a minister, committed to a craft and a community, still writing, still traveling, still speaking truth, and still measuring a night by how it leaves people when the sound goes down.